This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 30. And as it's a big round number, I'm especially delighted today to be joined by one of the giants of the London fintech scene, Anil Stocker, CEO and co-founder of Market Invoice. I cannot think of one sector of fintech where there has been adequate competition, where the leading player has left their competitors so far behind in their wake as Market Invoice has done in invoice finance. I have long been a fan of Market Invoice, so much so that a year ago, when a friend was discussing with me his son's business expansion and the need for working capital when dealing with major buyers, I had no hesitation in saying there's one name he should contact, Market Invoice. A year later, they're now a case study on Market Invoice's website, their business is booming, and so I know by direct experience that far from being abstract, good financial services, good fintech, can act as an enabler for people to grow businesses in the real world. And what's better than that? A little background on Market Invoice. Businesses use Market Invoice to selectively sell their invoices to a network of global investors, giving businesses immediate access to funds otherwise tied up for between 30 and 120 days. Businesses are able to sell single invoices online as and when they need to. There are no contracts, hidden fees, or personal guarantees. New clients can sign up in as little as a day or two. Once signed up, they can sell an invoice and draw down funds on the same day. Launched in 2011, Market Invoice has already helped hundreds of businesses overcome the lengthy payment terms of the large customers. Over £400 million has been raised through the platform, with businesses using the funds to hire more staff, launch new products, and pay their suppliers. In the fintech world, Market Invoice has long had a reputation for having good returns. Sadly, however, it hasn't been so easy to put the money in there. As invoice finance turns over the portfolio very rapidly compared to some other longer-term loans, they've generally been closed for new money going in, and in general, they've discouraged retail investment. However, later in the show, Anil will talk to us about some exciting news for the future, and maybe some of these things will change, and maybe you too might have a chance to invest your money in this platform. So there's plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Anil. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here, especially on your 30th show. And it's really great that there are programs existing such as this one that really trying to get under the skin of fintech and some of the issues. I should also thank you for referring that business to us. You know, it's testament to the fact that they're now one of our case studies and biggest supporters.
Excellent. I'm just still quite amused as to why my invoice hasn't been paid for the introductory fee. And I will also try not to get under your skin. I'll try to get under your business's bonnet.
I thought you were doing it out of the goodness of your heart, Mike.
Of course. Well, I am actually. But that's my insanity when it comes back to business. There's a very bad business model going on here. So I quiz people on their better ones and try and copy them. So before we talk about the exciting world of invoice financing and fintech, I noticed that we have a little bit in common at a bit of a length in that originally my family used to be far more sensible and they lived in a nice place called Switzerland, which has nice seasons and winters and lakes and mountains and all that kind of stuff. And then rather unfortunately, a couple of generations ago, they moved to this country where we don't have so many nice lakes, mountains, and such decent weather. Anyway, I can actually blame my ancestors, but in your case, you have to blame yourself because you were born and lived in Switzerland, and then now you're living in London for some strange reason.
Well, Switzerland is an amazing place, beautiful country. I came over when I was fairly young, 10, 11 years old, and then I'm very much a Londoner now, went to school here, studied economics at Cambridge, where I actually met the co-founders of Market Invoice. That's where we all got together. I then, for my sins, followed the path into financial services. Back in 2006, the city was devouring most graduates from Cambridge and Oxford and other leading universities.
Is Oxford a leading university? I thought it was about third or fourth in the league table these days.
Well, yeah, we have to include them, I guess.
Absolutely.
I think that, you know, a lot of people were going into the city working for big corporates. I think that's changed a lot recently. And so I went and worked in a private equity fund that was actually part of Lehman Brothers. I saw a high intensity environment. I learned a lot. I spoke to a lot of businesses. I met a lot of businesses. And I guess it was against this backdrop of talking to financial directors and business owners that I started to get the idea of looking into online finance and fintech.
I was talking a year ago to a local school, to sixth formers, about how the world of work has changed forever. And saying saying to them that going forwards they've really got, in caricature terms, a stark choice between kind of becoming part of a factory, whether it's public or private sector or law or banking, or going down a more sort of entrepreneurially startup route. And the person that had organised that was the head of economics and business studies there, and he was bemoaning the fact that all the students that were doing his A-level course and going on to do economics at university, by and large, ended up being very good at writing essays, and the correlation between writing nice essays and actually being a good businessman was relatively low. So he was rather sort of saddened by his own trade. So you mentioned doing economics, which can get incredibly abstract and almost irrelevant. So how did that smoothly liaise into actually being a businessman?
Well, not very smoothly at all, to be honest.
Threw the textbooks away.
I think that, yeah, what you learn at university is a great training for the mind. I remember studying mathematics, microeconomics, econometrics. You know, these things really push you, and you learn the skill of taking vast amount of information and understanding it and synthesizing it. But yeah, coming out of Cambridge and going into the world of finance was a massive learning curve. And I actually think that some of the university systems in other countries prepare people better for that. I remember starting in banking, and French, Swedish, German counterparts were much better versed in some of the hard skills of finance. But look, I think to bring it back to fintech now, I think what's interesting, I have a brother who's just 24, 25 coming out of university, and there's much less of a draw into the city. I think a lot more smart young people are looking at, you know, working for Apple, working for bigger tech companies, Google, but also looking at companies that are scaling and learning from that experience. For example, joining a Market Invoice now, we're about 75 people and we're growing, you know, that's going to be a really interesting training ground before launching your own business. So I think quite a lot of entrepreneurial people want to join the startup scene here in London as opposed to going into a big corporate.
Absolutely. And I think there's some very valuable advice in there. People often say to me, next to no experience in anything, oh, I want to do a startup. And my advice almost always to these people is, why don't you go and work for a nice small company? I mean, I started my career in Bath, where I was number 12 in a tech startup, which was 55 people strong 18 months later. And that's a seminal experience that I remember all the time in fintech now. So there's no better training ground than to learn from your elders and betters, even if your elders and betters are only 10 years older than you.
Definitely. I think it's very hard to come out of university, launch a company. I think very few people can do that. Yeah. Of course, some, if you're a brilliant coder or you're the Mark Zuckerberg of this world, that's what they did. But I think getting some ground training in a startup that's scaling, and there's actually now in London quite a few that are scaling across fintech, would be a good option.
Yes, and I think the other thing is it's really important to be lucky in terms of the time when you leave university, because there are these small windows of opportunity which open and then they close. And the other thing which slightly scares me about university graduates joining sectors is that generally, whenever I've seen that, 2 or 3 years later, that sector blows up, fucks up, or goes badly wrong, because students are always sort of lagging indicators of what's actually sort of quite cool. So they tend to join at the top of the market. They're all joining in the 80s when I was joining myself. And I'm now seeing this from a slightly different perspective, as my elder daughter has just finished her AS levels, which is now used as the basis for university entry. And she's busy looking at what she's going to do and starting to think about what she's going to do when she comes out. And hopefully fintech is still there. So just before we move on to invoice financing, as you say, you've got a background in financial services, which not everybody has. I mean, on the podcast, off the top of my head, Ridian Lewis, the CEO of RateSetto, and Conrad Ford of Funding Options, had a background in FS, which, you know, I think helps significantly. What lessons did you take away from being an FS person, in older FS as it were, that you found sort of useful in terms of applying in fintech?
Look, I think there's a lot of things that I learned during my time in financial services. One is the importance of attention to detail. People forget that, you know, what we're doing here, it sounds simple, and we make it look simple from the outside, which is the beauty of it. But behind our platform, a lot of things are happening, right? We're using data to think about how we market and present our business. We're using technology. You're looking at risk models and understanding what companies we accept, what companies we reject, how we monitor companies, how we raise limits, how we lower limits, depending on the latest information. We're also running a business. You also have to write a business plan. You have to do financial forecasting. You have to make some assumptions. And again, that also comes back to a lot of what I was doing when I was in financial services around looking at business plans, looking at profit and loss, income statement, cash flow. These are quite technical things which require quite a lot of training and time to understand and to speak the language of business, which many businesses, the CEO has to do that, or they hire a CFO. And as they become bigger, these things actually become quite complicated. And I think finally, legal, you know, at the end of the day, we're also using a lot of law in terms of the rules of engagement, what happens when things go wrong. And again, that's something that you learn to respect in financial services.
Yes, I think FS is much more complex on the inside than it appears on the outside. On the outside, you know, running a bank, you take deposits, you make loans, how hard can it be? Well, the answer is actually quite hard. And going back to what you say in FS, the devil is generally in the detail. And when I was running a fixed interest fund management, we used to take the best graduates going from the investment management division. You know, and somebody would turn up with a PhD in Goethe, so they're extremely intelligent. But I would deliberately put them on some very menial tasks, such as writing out fixed term deposit sheets that deals have been done. We used to drive them around the bend. But sooner or later, they would make a mistake. And I would have the opportunity to call them into my office, sit there very formally and say, OK, you wrote 5 million, not 500,000, and actually the cost of that is 165,000 now. Now, do you want me to deduct it from your salary? At which point they would get the point that actually in financial services in general, it is more important to be almost error-free than it is to be an absolute genius. You can be a genius later on, but you've got to have this solid start of not making mistakes. And going back to teenagers, I'm having a similar thing at the moment, which is that one of my daughters is quite good at forgetting her front door keys. I'm slowly trying to get over the message. Look, there are some things you can't forget.
Look, I agree that, you know, we have the same thing. We're moving money around, and the systems we build need to be robust, and we can't allow money to go to somewhere where it shouldn't go. But having said that, we are employing PhD-level guys looking at our risk models, how we underwrite, how we use technology, how we bring data in. You know, we have people, I have a super smart guy who did machine learning at university, building algorithms. These are extremely important because the world has changed. We can process and crunch a lot of data very quickly, and that's really helping us.
Absolutely, and I think people from that kind of background have been brought up for quite some time on the fact that the detail really matters. If you're a coder, one small detail can make a big difference. I remember reading about one of the first space probes in the 1960s where it missed the planet completely. It must be one of the best coding bugs of all time. It missed the planet because they had a comma rather than a full stop somewhere, but it's still scanned and compiled and all that kind of stuff. So a comma and a full stop missed the planet, you know. So it's this non-linear impact of making mistakes and all that kind of thing.
Definitely.
So going on to the invoice financing, I think people by now are fairly familiar with invoice financing and why that's important. It's a very important way to access capital, and people sending milk to Tesco's, we're very familiar with the fact that Tesco's is going to pay them in quite a while. In the meantime, they've got to pay the feed for the cows and all that kind of stuff. But maybe you want to say a little bit about the size of the market, because I think people generally don't know how big it is, even if a lot of people do know that one of the ways of sourcing finance is to actually lend against their invoices.
Definitely. So invoice finance is really a way for us to give money to businesses so they can fund their operations. Think of it as this is the oxygen of finance they need month in, month out to pay their suppliers, grow their team, invest in marketing, export to a new market. So managing your cash, like from waiting for it to come in and paying your suppliers, is very difficult. Invoice finance allows you to unlock that cash. And it's a big, big market. At any given point in time, there's 20 billion outstanding.
In the UK?
In the UK only. In the year, that's about 200 billion. But it's underutilized. Most business owners, although they have some vague idea that it exists, don't really know how they can access it, or they have a negative perception of it, which is why only 50,000 companies out of a million in the UK are using invoice finance.
Being very slow here, 50,000, that's 5% of the market, so 95% aren't.
Yeah, 95% aren't because they feel that it's not the right product for them. And that's just because it's the way that it's been structured historically, which has meant that business owners don't want to use it. Our mission here is to really show the business community that they can use our form of invoice finance, simple, online, flexible, transparent, to get the cash into their company and grow. And it's a very good way of unlocking the most amount of cash possible.
Yes, there's obviously a lot in what you say there. I mean, just trying to think back historically to sort of decades ago, when would I first have heard of it? I think I probably wouldn't have heard of it in those terms. I probably heard of it like as factoring or something, and factoring something to do with metal bashing. I've got no idea what it is, and it's complicated and obscure and all that kind of stuff. And going back to the title of the show being invoice financing in the fintech age, one of the things about tech in general, and certainly about the successful fintechs, is they make it simple and clear.
Absolutely.
No mystique. This is what you do. This is what you get.
Yeah, so we have a couple of goals. We want to make our product all online. So we don't want there to be any physical meetings, any physical paper. You can go online, you can sign up online, you can get approved, you can get your funding same day or next day. So all online. We want to be super transparent. Invoice finance and factoring has suffered from lots of hidden fees. It's not regulated. Lots of the providers are adding in fees left, right, and center. So businesses don't really understand how much they're paying. We want to make that super transparent. We also want to make it flexible. The banks and traditional finance providers lock customers in for a year, 2 years, facility. It's very hard to come out of it. And that's what makes it very expensive, because even if you don't use it, you've got to pay. So by offering on demand, so you can pick and choose when you use us, what projects, what end customers, you can really drive down the costs that you're charging. And also, we're using better data and we're making better risk decisions to allow us to give more funding than the banks would give. Banks are very good at taking collateral. They just want to take collateral as their security. We're doing a lot more work in figuring out the risk and using technology to do that better and are able to give businesses more money at better terms.
So again, everything differs, but just in terms of fag packets, let's say I've got, I don't know, $100,000 of milk invoices outstanding at Tesco's or something like that, which is actually, I was about to say, it's a good credit. It isn't as good as it was a couple of years ago in credit terms. Typically, what would banks advance against $100,000? What would you advance typically?
So basically, what the banks would do is they'd say, okay, you have this company, you're supplying lots of customers, I'm going to finance against your whole ledger, all your invoices. Typically, around 60, 70% they're advancing. With us, what you can do is you can sign up and you can say, okay, I've got customers that pay me on time, but I've just got Tesco, Unilever, or whoever, who are taking a long time. So I can take those invoices and I can get up to 85%, 90%. Of course, the more you use us, the more your limit will go up as we learn more about you. And the fees will also come down over time. So, you know, typically you're getting 85% up front. You still get the remaining 15%, less maybe the discount that you're paying, the actual fee you're paying might range anywhere between 1% and 3%. So you're basically getting 97, 98 cents in the dollar or pence in the pound.
And that's over what kind of term, shortest to longest?
Yeah. We range. We do 15 days right up to 120 days, but the average is around 50 days at the moment. So businesses, usually the funds are outstanding for about 50 days, which means that it turns quite quickly.
And anybody who's involved in needing this will understand the importance of cash loan organisations. I mean, those people who don't have such a business background or haven't been involved in businesses that have to do this, the fact that's always stuck in my mind is that most businesses that go bust are making a profit. It's just they run out of cash.
Exactly.
You say it's oxygen, it's the same thing. No oxygen, you're dead.
That's what we say. Cash is the oxygen of finance. I mean, to put it in perspective, just to give you an example, we have this great company, they produce headphones. They're called Rockjaw. They're made in the UK, everything designed, built, manufactured in the UK. It's a real UK success story. They're turning over £2 million, they want to get to £6 million, and they signed up some big Japanese retailers in Japan. And they pay on 90 days. Now, this is an extremely profitable piece of business for them. It's a game changer in terms of their company's profile, sell their headphones in Japan, and they wouldn't have been able to make that work. They didn't have the cash to make that work. So they would have to forego revenue and profit because they didn't have the cash in the business to get the stuff made. And so we're able to help them there. They're doing 200,000, 300,000 pound invoices. They're accelerating that cash and getting it done and exporting.
And going back to this transparency and enabling competitiveness, just jogging back a little bit, maybe I understood or misunderstood that. So you said that if I, let's say me, the London FinTech podcast, I suddenly get lots of invoices for some reason I can't imagine, and I go along to a bank and I want to factor them and they sign me up. Am I locked into that bank?
Yep. You're locked into that.
So in 6 months' time, when they quote me a price, I can't really go anywhere else.
That's the thing. We've seen companies, and the main feedback when we talk to businesses is that, you know, when you get into factoring with a bank, it's very hard to get out. Right. And so that means that a lot of companies are trying to fish around for other sources of finance. They raise equity or they try and get a long-term loan, which just doesn't really solve their problem. And that's what we see as the big opportunity. Remember as well that the funding that comes through our platform is, you know, we're peer-to-peer, right? So we have high net worth, sophisticated investors, institutions, we've got pension funds, we've got the UK government through the British Business Bank, we've got local authorities, Manchester Local Council. They're all putting money in, which ensures that we get the best possible price and the most amount of money as we're able to syndicate it across all these investors.
Yes, and we'll come on to how you sort of match up both sides later, because it's an interesting thing coming back to being able to supply funds on the same day means that you've got to have some sort of sloshing around in the first place, which means, of course, there's some dilution to the investor. But let's come back to squaring that circle in a minute. But just continuing this sort of vein of thought, train of thought. So traditionally, people will go to a bank, they're then locked into this arrangement, they take whatever price is going, and you know the bank says, oh, because of headquarters changed arrangements, it's now 40%, not 60% or something, and that's it. Otherwise, you've got to go and negotiate another. Whereas, just for the avoidance of doubt, what I'm understanding is that if I'm discounting my invoices to you, and in 6 months' time, I go to you and you don't offer me a good price, I say, thank you very much, but I go somewhere else.
The beauty of it is that the more you use us, the more data we have, the more competitive it becomes. So typically, businesses who use us, the first few times that they use us are going to be more expensive. As we get a better profile, we see a track record, funding goes up, price comes down. So we've had companies that have started off paying maybe 1.5% every month, falling right down to 0.5%. So it's a massive reduction in cost. So it actually, there's huge network effects from staying with Market Invoice, proving your track record and continuing to use us.
And is this because you're viewing yourself as having a credit risk on the company as well as on the invoice to Tesco's?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So we screen the businesses that apply very carefully. as well as the end customers. And why? Because it is recourse finance. So if for whatever reason the invoice doesn't get paid, the small company does have to reimburse what it's borrowed.
And so just pressing pause there, because again, going back to the obscure terminology, not everyone understands. So there's recourse and there's non-recourse.
Yeah, well, non-recourse is a very small amount. Typically, right. It's bundled in with all sorts of insurance products as well.
Just to define the terms then, so non-recourse finance versus recourse finance for people who've not heard of the terms before.
Yeah, so basically recourse is when you're still on the hook, right? So if the invoice doesn't get paid, you as a small business have to repay that, right? Non-recourse, which is a very, very tiny part of the market, is where it's like sell and forget. So you sell the debt off.
I've sold my invoice that Tesco's is going to pay me in 3 months' time for the milk to somebody else.
Yeah.
If they pay or don't pay, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
I've sold it.
Yeah. That's non-recourse, but that's very small.
Very small.
Very small, very expensive usually.
Generally, the recourse finance is that Tesco's don't pay because Tesco's has gone bust. And I'm in the shit because I've still got to pay.
The likelihood of Tesco going bust is extremely small. I'd say that the major risk is mainly around trade disputes. So something that happens, they dispute the invoice, or they say that the quality of the goods is not very good.
Okay, the milk was sour.
Yeah. It's more applicable to service-based businesses. If you're a digital design company or app developer, you can tell that in some or construction, you know, there are some sectors where there's a greater incidence of trade dispute.
People say the software didn't work, we're not paying for it.
Exactly.
Or we don't like that design.
Exactly. Which means that, yes, certain sectors are riskier, but whereas a bank will just say, we're not going to provide any funding for those sectors. So banks are actually very bad at providing capital in the service-based economy. So software, technology, design, press, creative, fashion. We're able to make a market in those sectors and actually provide finance, albeit it might be slightly less limits and it might be slightly more expensive. So we're seeing a lot of attraction, a lot of applications that are coming from the service-based economy. That's where we're really doing well.
Oh, that's interesting, because I hadn't actually ever come across that point. And it's kind of understandable that banks like tangible security.
Yes.
And security tends to imply sort of, you know, buildings or IBM is going to pay you $1 million or something.
So banks are very good at doing that.
But we're in a much more intangible world these days because everything's more and more servicey and tangible.
I mean, what are the UK good at? What's the UK exporting? They're exporting services,
what
education.
What are we good at, actually?
Britain is great at many things, including software, gaming, apps. We've also, you know, education, training. We've got companies that are using us who are doing training for foreign governments. And so it's really the backbone of the UK economy, and it's not well understood by the existing banking infrastructure, especially the smaller end.
So there's this intangibility advantage you guys have, as well as the other ones I mentioned earlier about sort of faster, more transparent and that kind of stuff. And then coming back to this point about matching the lenders and the borrowers. So if you're being nice to the borrowers, then, you know, they can draw down money today and I send you an invoice and suddenly for some reason I need $1 million or something like that. Then obviously you need to have $1 million sitting around, otherwise you can't give it to me. And obviously vice versa for the lenders, that produces a certain amount of cash drag because you're sort of sitting there and it's getting 0.5% in a bank or whatever customer account it's in or something like that.
So we have to manage this quite carefully. So how it works is that you're a high net worth investor. We don't go down to retail. I'll come back to that. But if you're high net worth, you have to start with £50,000. £50,000 is the minimum requirement. That gets put into a client account. And then what happens is that you see all the risk bands and you allocate your portfolio into the different risk bands, 1 to 10. 1 being the safest, 10 being the riskiest. And then each time there's a transaction that falls into your risk parameters, you get deployed, right? You're right in that we will always have more money on the platform than small businesses and invoices, because we want to ensure that we always have liquidity, which also means that we have to wait list investors who are coming on. So we're adding the funding gradually as we grow our invoice volumes. So we're trying to aim to be 85% deployed. Investors are 85% deployed, which means that there's about a 15% cash drag. But even if you take our returns, net of cash drag, net of defaults, net of everything, we delivered about 11% last year. We're looking to deliver about 8-9% this year. These are attractive returns.
Absolutely, absolutely, given what bank rates are and that you've got a relatively low default rate. Now, going to the bands from 1 to 10, what is your average portfolio then, when the numbers you're quoting? Is it average 5 or average 2 or 3, the wristband?
No, I'd say that we have a lot of transactions in 2, 3, 4.
And what is that in external currency, like in terms of AAA, AA, single A, investment grade?
It doesn't map entirely onto the kind of AA, triple
A. Well, A1, P1 or whatever commercial paper ratings.
They're all pretty safe. Our default rate, to put it in perspective, overall is less than 0.1% for 7,000 transactions, 430 million through the platform. This is a best-in-class default rate.
Even
where things have gone into default, we've collected really well because there's an underlying security. This is not unsecured lending. Here, investors are buying invoices, they're buying assets. right? So you're quite right, going back to the Moody's and Standard & Poor's ratings, which people have heard of, that's long-term debt ratings, that's not comparable. But in terms of commercial paper ratings, which is a shorter-term rating, which is more comparable, you're still talking about A1, P1, the top kind of stuff.
Of course, the top ones. I mean, what we're talking about is like businesses that are supplying into the FTSE 100, FTSE 250 end customers. What would be slightly riskier would be companies that are exporting, because you're going cross to another jurisdiction, so if you're invoicing to the US or the Far East or the Middle East, that would have a little bit more risk associated with it, because should anything go wrong, you know, we'd have to go and collect in these foreign jurisdictions, which would be harder and more costly.
Exactly. So there's different sources of risk then in invoice financing. And picking on what you said earlier, would it be true to say then that credit risk isn't necessarily one of the main ones, but trade disputes are? Actually, the goods weren't received very well, as well as natural ones like fraud, which affects all businesses.
Well, fraud affects everything, and that's something that all fintech and peer-to-peer players are completely 100% focused on. You know, we're doing a lot of checks on the businesses, the people within the businesses, fraud checks to check whether people are real. We're doing financial checks, financial stability checks. We're also verifying how long businesses have been around and trading with their counterparties. Because if you've got a business that's been trading 10 years with Unilever, you can be sure that, you know, that's a relationship that has been and stood the test of time, and they've delivered good work in for them. So the likelihood of trade dispute is lower. Yeah. So we're doing statistical analysis, financials, fraud, director checks. And then obviously the data that we build up as companies use us is very predictive as well. So we're seeing exactly how they're getting paid. Are they getting paid late? What's happening with their payments and their cash flow?
And on this intangibles point, because just thinking off the top of my head. So I do a piece of work for somebody. I do a piece of design work for somebody, and I send them an invoice, and then I try and ask you to discount it. How do you understand the likelihood of the customer not coughing up because my design wasn't very good?
Getting successfully paid on an invoice is correlated to a couple of things. How long your business has been around, what is the historical track record that you've had in delivering this design work. There's a big difference from a company that's just launched and doing its first piece of design work to a company that's done it year in, year out for 5 years. So we're looking at that. And we are also verifying that work has been completed. So we actually do verify with end customers that they've received the invoice and signed off on the invoice.
Ah, signed off. Okay, so that's very important then. Okay, it's not just that I posted an invoice to somebody.
No. We're doing a lot of checks behind the scenes.
Right. Interesting. Good. Well, that's all very clear. And I think we can take as read that, you know, because you're so far ahead of everyone else, that you're doing it much better than everyone else, and that you've got these general advantages of fintech, that you're clear and transparent and all that kind of thing. So moving on from the sort of invoicing sector, where is Market Invoice going in the next sort of 6-12 months?
So we're really, really excited about what we're building here. We had a record month in June, just last month. We did over £25 million of funding. We've now done over 7,000 transactions. We've advanced in total over £430 million to UK businesses. We're working on a bunch of things. We're building out the team. We're 65 people here now in London. We're recruiting a lot in technology and business development and partnerships. We're integrating with e-accountancy platforms that just makes us pull even more data seamlessly from our users to increase that experience, to augment that experience of getting signed up really quickly. And so I'd say that, you know, a couple of things on our roadmap is we're looking to widen our product, we're looking to enhance it. So we started with this invoice finance product. We're now opening it up to licenses. So imagine you're a business, you're a SaaS-based business, a software as a service, and you're invoicing every month and you're getting a subscription every month. You can roll 12 months forward into one upfront payment, which is an extremely useful product for tech businesses and is really resonating. We're looking at some purchase order finance as well. So purchase order finance is the bit that comes before the invoice. Right. So imagine you're a wholesaler, you're getting stuff made in China and selling it on Amazon. What you can do is we're trying to introduce a product that will let you to put the down payments, the prepayments in China to get you the goods. It's a riskier, it's earlier in the cycle, but it's kind of two sides of the same coin.
So you're going into adjacent verticals.
Going into adjacent verticals. We're also drilling down on certain sectors that are really working for us. And then I think that on the big innovation that we're looking at, and you alluded to this in the beginning, is we didn't take retail money. Why? In the beginning, because, you know, we hadn't tested the product. We didn't know the risk profile. We wanted to get this track record under our belts. We didn't want to just open it up to anyone.
You didn't want to give it to widows and orphans at that stage.
No, exactly. You know, you can imagine the nightmare scenario of retail investors putting money into something and not understanding the risks. Now we've really understood it. We've done a lot of transactions. We're on version 4 of our risk model. We've learned very quickly because of the short duration nature of our product. We see any problems after 50 days, we're able to adjust our risk models. Now what that means is that we now have the confidence to hopefully next year, we want to start opening up a way for retail investors to start participating with as little as £1,000.
And I think that's going to be very appealing to people for the reasons I say, that you know, you guys within the industry, which is always a good measure, have an excellent reputation and an excellent record. And as you say, it's not unsecured lending. And I think the other thing, wearing my risk hat, which is easy to underestimate when people lump everybody together as doing the same kind of thing, oh, it's all marketplace lending or it's all peer-to-peer. It isn't. It is apples and oranges. And you guys are much more of a flow business. You do transactions and you find out 2 weeks to a couple of months later that that failed or succeeded. So you've got lots and lots of data points about how successful you are, and therefore you're much better able to accurately assess the risk of, shall we say, over the next 3 months than the peer-to-peers that are doing longer-term loans, which now go out to 10 years.
Yes.
So obviously, if I set up a business tomorrow, I'm doing 10-year deals. Well, in 10 years' time, I find out how successful I was. And so it's much harder for me to actually know myself, let alone for the lenders to know how risky that is, as opposed to you guys who say we've had 7,000 transactions.
Exactly. No, that's a really important point you've made there. Peer-to-peer, there's a lot of platforms launching right now. There's a lot of new entrants. And I think as an investor, you've got to really make sure you understand the risks associated with each product. I think there are some commentators and journalists who are kind of confusing a little bit the proposition by lumping all of peer-to-peer or marketplace lenders together. There's a big difference between secured lending, unsecured lending, consumer lending, asset-backed, mortgage, and absolutely, as you're right, if you're originating long-term loans, 5-year loans, 10-year loans, you have to wait for those vintages to mature in 5 years. You can't take your money out very easily unless there's a mature secondary market, and we don't know yet how much liquidity will exist on these secondary markets. And all these platforms want to grow very fast, so they're all going to talk about how many loans they've originated, but you need to keep a track on the default rate. What we really know, when you look at the numbers at Market Invoices, you know that our default rate is real. We've learned, you know, you can see it very quickly, what it is and how we can react to that. And you know that the returns that we're delivering every year are not just notional returns, they're actual returns.
Yes, and to pick a very strange analogy, it's a bit like you're comparing two vineyards, and one is a traditional vineyard and it takes a year to make a bottle of wine. And after 10 years, you've got a good idea how well it makes wine on average. And the other is, for the sake of argument, a vineyard where the grapes grow in a month and it makes 12 vintages per annum.
Yes.
And after a much shorter period of time, in the second case, you think, hey, these guys, 90% of the time, make a really good bottle of wine.
Yes.
But it would take you 10 years to find out what the other guy does.
Exactly right. And we can refine those vintages. We can, like, you know, we can test, we can add new streams in and new grapes and figure out much quicker the optimal bottle of wine.
Absolutely. And it was a conversation I was having with Mike Lavin, the CEO of Currency Cloud, who had now done $10 billion. And I was saying to him that one of the advantages of having done large volumes is by now the things that happen 1 in 1,000 times, you see many times. You know, the obscure risks, you know, once you do one transaction or 10 or 100 or 1,000, you're finding more and more obscure cock-ups. And it comes back to my favourite programme on financial services risk, although probably only me in the world thinks of it this way, which is Air Crash Investigates. And if you look at something like the 747 or any new airplane, the first year it crashes for some fairly obvious things, but they're still crashing 10 or 20 years later, but the risk is going down because it's even more rare events. It's the 1 in 100 risk, it's the 1 in 1,000 risk, it's the 1 in 10,000 risk. So I think that's another reason why I'd certainly recommend that investors, lenders, whatever, do look at mature platforms such as yours, do look at the ones that are the market leaders in the industry and give more weight than perhaps they might have thought of in the first place to those businesses that are actually turning it over fairly shortly. I've seen the opposite argument in essence advanced, which is that, oh, you know, our portfolio is £700 million, you know, as if that's a sign of sort of dick measuring contest machismo. But actually it's vice versa, because that implies they've got a lot of stuff that hasn't worked through the system. You guys are much more of a flow business, seeing things come and go.
Yeah, absolutely. No, look, we operate in a big market. We're growing. There's no reason that we can't be doing hundreds of millions a month, currently at 25 million a month, but growing strongly. And as we extend our product, our vision is to become the destination of choice for small businesses, for everything that they need for their working capital, for that oxygen of funding that is less than a year in maturity. So anything that's less than a year long, whether it be like short-term loans, invoice finance, purchase order finance, we want to be that number one place, and we believe that we can achieve that in the next 5 to 10 years.
Absolutely. And I think the final point I'd like to make on risk, which is that you can't manage risk any more than you can manage your life. I mean, we might all be hit by a meteorite tomorrow, we might be killed crossing the road, but all you can do is just try your best to manage it. and stay on the case. And in terms of a start of the show with the benefit of this, I know the benefit of this. It's a bit like when you recommend to a friend, oh, go and see this film, it's a great film. You're a bit on risk, really, because they're going to come back and say, well, it was all right, but it wasn't that good. But I have had the experience long before I met you, of a year ago, recommending to somebody, and very satisfied customers at this stage. And as you say, those people who've been fortunate enough to manage to get their money through your rather small window in the first place have got very good returns from you. And it's very interesting that you're going to other verticals next year and going to put more money in there. And I think it's really interesting for people to have a look at it and keep an eye on how you're doing. And I wish you every success in the future.
Well, thanks a lot. Been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app. Or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.